Farhan, thanks for coming on. How are you?
Good, Steve. Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, let's start with the Canucks. I guess my jumping off point is going to be the value of Kevin Fiala in that trade. Does that impact at all what's happening with Brock Besser and the Vancouver Canucks?
Well, it depends how you want to look at it. I mean, I know that they're two players that are the same age, and people have, you know, looked at the number, you know, on that contract, which is a long-term deal at just under $8 million. And statistically, those two guys have had similar seasons, but I think Fiala's been a much bigger impact guy in Minnesota and certainly showed that this past year where he was a point-of-game guy, right? If you look at Brock Besser, you know, we've long felt he's had the ability to be a 40-goal scorer, but it just hasn't happened for him yet. You know, he still scored at a reasonable clip, but there's been some inconsistency. There's been some injuries. And, you know, in fairness to Brock, right, he's had some difficult emotional seasons because of what's been going on with his father and his father's health, who recently passed. And, you know, the two have been so close, and he's had all of that weigh on him. Now, you know, how does that impact things going forward? It's really hard to say. But the bottom line is that, you know, it's a complicated situation, right? He's got a $7.5 million qualifying offer. He's currently not a $7.5 million player. The Canucks would like to keep him, and they'd like to get him to some sort of a bridge deal, which is what he signed the last time, at a cap hit below $7 million. But the player's got all the leverage, right? Because he's got that QO that's due on July 11th, and he's got to make that decision. And because of that status, it makes a trade for Brock Besser very complicated, right? I mean, his player value and his trade value don't necessarily line up. So, you know, is there a solution there? My understanding is that discussions have been going very slowly, and the Canucks would like to keep him. He'd like to stay, but I just don't know what the solution here is at this point.
Wow, that is incredibly complicated. Can they move on from Brock Besser if they can't find some kind of common ground and get a deal?
I don't think so. I don't think they're going to move on, and they're going to want to protect the asset. And again, the trade value is just not going to be high enough.
Yep.
So there's two scenarios here, right? One is that he signs a front-loaded, you know, three-year deal, let's say, at, you know, $20 million for the sake of argument, you know, so that gets your AAV at around 6.7, you know, that could be the compromise. And, you know, but I think a more likely scenario is that he signs his qualifying offer and they buy time for a year and
right.
See what happens, you know, in the coming season when, you know, he's not, you know, emotionally when he's in potentially a different place because he's not, you know, worrying about his father's health at home on a daily basis. And if he can stay healthy, you know, you see what happens at that point. And, you know, maybe that winds up being the solution, which, again, wouldn't be ideal for the club because it's a big number. But, you know, and a lot of it is tied to JT Miller as well, right? I mean, I think the more likely scenario is the club trades JT Miller sometime here in the next couple of weeks before the draft and, you know, frees up a little bit of money and potentially brings some asset value back the other way because that deal is much cleaner because you know what you're dealing with. You don't have the complicating factor of a QO that's due to a player who doesn't necessarily justify that number.
Do you think that Brock Besser, because it's one thing, maybe the answer is just buy some time, sign the QO and go, but the player's got to agree to sign the QO. If it came to that
Farhan,
do you believe that the player would do that?
Oh, yeah, in a heartbeat.
Yeah, okay.
For sure. Yeah, if the club offers it, which they will, and that's not to say that they can't still, you know, renegotiate, but yeah, he would absolutely sign the qualifying offer is my understanding.
Okay, let's pivot more to JT Miller. What a season. I mean, 99 points. He can play all three forward positions. He can play the game any way you want. 29 years old, so a little bit older, but still there's plenty left in the tank here. What are we talking about, you think, with a trade value for JT Miller?
Well, I mean, you know, you look at Fiala, you're probably looking at that type of deal plus one, right? Where you get a, you know, a high draft pick, a highly regarded young player that fills a need, and you know, a third asset somewhere along the way, right? A roster player type of thing. You know, my understanding is there's a lot of interest in JT Miller. And, you know, there was last year. It slowed down before the trade deadline as the club started to, you know, improve its form and got itself back into playoff contention. And they decided not to make that deal because they knew they still had asset value in him this offseason. So it's going to take a lot to get him. It's probably not what people were thinking about when his name first got broached in the conversations last January, let's say. But certainly a sizable haul has got to come back the other way because he is a very good player, as you say. I just don't see a scenario where the Canucks are going to give him a seven-year deal at over $8 million a year, given his current age, right? And if you're JT Miller, you want your extension now. You want the past season to be your platform year, 99-point season, you know, outlined by everything you said that he can do, right? So I think both sides want to get some clarity, and I think that's going to come in the next couple of weeks. And, you know, like you look at Colorado, and I'm not saying the Canucks are the Colorado Avalanche, but you got to make some hard decisions, right? And sometimes those hard decisions, you know, could require you to take not necessarily a step back, but a step in a different direction to build your lineup. And I just don't know that it makes a lot of sense to sign him and get into a contract like that that's going to weigh you down in year, you know, year four and year five, because your actual contention window might not hit until then.
Yeah, and I guess that's the question I have, Farhan. It's like, where do you see them kind of on that franchise trajectory in terms of being a legitimate playoff team? Like, does that even line up with what JT Miller would expect in terms of a contract?
Yeah, I don't know that it does, right? And look, I don't know how you get better trading JT Miller in the 2022-2023 season, but you could be better 2 and 3 years down the line if you execute it the right way and get the right pieces back, right?
Yeah.
And the Canucks aren't looking to stockpile draft picks, right? They do have a core that includes Elias Pettersson, Quinn Hughes, Thatcher Demko, and Bo Horvat. And when you look at that core, it's really good, right? I mean, Demko's a top five goalie in the league. Pettersson, you know, when he's healthy, is a top, you know, potentially a top 10 point producer in the league. Quinn Hughes is a top 10 defenseman in the league, right? Like, they've got some meaningful pieces that they can build off going forward, right? So when you look at that, it's not a team that has to completely rebuild and start over, right? So I think, I think they're in a good place from that end. So it's not, you know, you want guys that can be players that can compete for roster spots next season and can really be part of that next wave and add to that core. So, you know, do I think they're a team that can make the playoffs next year? Sure, I think they could. But, you know, they're not going to contend for a cup for quite some time.
Farhan Lalji's joining us. Now, we will pivot to the football game tonight in a moment, but it's been a big week here in Ottawa with Daniel Alfredsson getting the call to the Hall. How about the week it's been in Vancouver where Luongo and the Sedins get the call to the Hockey Hall of Fame and the buzz in that city?
Yeah, it's a big deal for sure, you know, and I said this with Jay Onright the other day, that you've got a franchise that hasn't won a cup, right? I mean, it's, and, you know, much like Ottawa, the success on the ice in terms of deep playoff runs has been limited, so you kind of view success differently, and a person like Daniel Alfredsson matters so much in Ottawa, and, you know, the Sedins and Roberto Luongo matter a ton here in Vancouver, especially the Twins, who exemplify everything that the most favored Canucks have had, right? When you look at guys like Stan Smeal and Trevor Linden and Marcus Naslund, they were people that not only excelled on the ice, but just did so much in the community. And the Sedins are at the top of that mountain, right? You know, for 18 years, when you look at their on-ice success, right, they were fifth and seventh, respectively, in league scoring over an 18-year sample size, right?
Yep.
A list that includes Crosby, Ovechkin, Ginla, Thornton, right? Like, it's a pretty good list. So on the ice, they did it, and off the ice, they did even more. And so for that, they are eternally loved here in Vancouver. And to see them go in together, to go in as first ballot Hall of Famers, and to go in with Roberto, I think was a really special start to the week here.
All right, let's pivot to the football. We got a big game tonight. Like I said off the top, Red Blacks played pretty well. Could have won one of those games, at least, with Winnipeg, but really couldn't finish off enough drives. And we all know how it's important for the Red Blacks to be more competitive this season. Farhan, you've been covering this league for years. And, of course, we had the lost season in general, but it was not trending in the right direction. So we'll see how the rest of the way goes here. Now, from the Lions' perspective, I know it's more than just one guy, but we just can't take our eyes off Nathan Rourke and what he's doing and being a Canadian here. You know, what have you seen from him that's allowed him to have this tremendous success out of the gate, and he's been the talk of the league?
Preparation and processing are probably the two things that come to mind the most, right? I mean, this guy prepares like a seasoned veteran starter, elite quarterback. I'm not telling you he is that. I mean, he was that for 2 weeks or two games, but that's just two games, right? But when you look at just his work ethic and his level of preparation, which he's shown at a very young age, I think it's remarkable, right? It takes a long time for people to learn how to prepare that way. But since day one, he's been first in, last out, learned how to, you know, game plan and digest information from a guy like Michael Riley. And, you know, the one thing that coaches have talked about is just the way he sees the game and the command that he's in, and talking to his offensive coordinator, just his full commitment to the game plan and the system and to his personnel, right? You know, I talked about this the other day, that Jordan McSimmick, the offensive coordinator, really kind of understood what Michael Riley wanted to do, and that was push the ball down the field. That might not have been what was best for the team, but that's how Michael played the game, and that was the way it was going to be, right? Whereas Nathan understands that, look, if the read takes me here and it's get the ball out of my hands and throw it quick, even if I need 9 yards for a first down, I'm going to trust my player to get the rest of the yardage, right? And that's really served BC well. They had, 35 first downs last week. So, you know, preparation and just processing, right, in terms of understanding not only what the defense gives you, but what your offense can best handle, I think those are the things that he's doing really well, and unbelievable he's doing it at such a young age.
It might have even been you that I heard make this point, but I think it's a great one when you think about the grooming of young quarterbacks. And that was because of Mike Riley's age, injury situation, that Rourke ended up taking many of the first team reps through practice just because Riley was being rested. How much of an impact did that have on his development? Because that's not usually an opportunity afforded a young quarterback. The number one guy is going to get, you know, whatever, 70%, 80% of the reps with the first team in practice. How much did that help prepare him and speed up his development?
I think it helped him a ton, right? Going up against a first team defense for as much of the time as he did in the first, you know, training camp, and then probably the first 10 weeks of the season, right? It allowed him to process the game at a high speed against very good players in an uncontrolled setting. And yes, it was controlled in that it was practice, but you know, the defense is going to throw everything it has at you, as opposed to, you know, when you take the last 8 reps in a period and everything is so scripted, including what defensive looks you're going to get, because they don't want to test you too much, right? Like, I think it helped him a ton, and just preparing like he was going to be a starter, because at any game he could have been, right? I think all of that helped him. But more than anything else, guys, it helped the team around him develop confidence, and the coaching staff develop confidence in him. Because when Brian Burnham and Lucky Whitehead had to make decisions this offseason as to what they were going to do with, you know, with their contracts and where they wanted to play, you know, and receivers' salaries are tied to what a quarterback around him can do, those two guys said, no, we've seen enough from this guy to know he's the real deal. Whereas if he was a backup the whole time, how would you know?
Yeah.
Right? Like, you just wouldn't. And they got to see it firsthand and believe in him. And that really helped pave the way for what you're seeing this year.
Farhan Lalji is joining us. So give us your thoughts on the Red Blacks. Like I said off the top there, they're competitive against a very good team the first 2 weeks, but this isn't horseshoes. You can't be close. You got to put some wins together. What have you seen so far with the Red Blacks?
I think they've exceeded my expectations, to be honest. And I know the record doesn't indicate that. This is a 2-0 football team. They are. They should have won both games against Winnipeg, in my mind. And their process has been really good. And I thought it would take them a bit longer because, quite frankly, as much as I think Sean Burke did a fabulous job this offseason rebuilding that team, I do think in certain areas, you know, he kind of just took what was there. And that's not his fault, because there weren't necessarily a lot more there, right? So I had huge questions about their offensive line, because the guys they brought in and rebuilt with in a lot of cases were spare parts. They were discarded guys, right? Even in other Canadian, even in other Canadian spots, right? They were just kind of guys. And but LaPolice and Benavides have done a great job putting those guys together and putting them in positions to be successful. Jeremiah Masoli has been very, very good so far this year. I just thought it would take them a little bit longer for their process to be as good as it's been. You know, they've only given up 19 points a game, and yeah, they've lost both, but that says something against a really good quarterback in Zach Caleros, right? So, and a really good offensive line in Winnipeg. So I'm really impressed with what I've seen. I think the results don't reflect how good they actually are. I think they're going to win the East, and I think they're going to win tonight.
The big story, of course, with BC has been work, but what else have they done so well to have a couple of blowout wins to start the season.
Their defense has been exceptional, right? I look at BC's back end, their secondary is the best in the league. And, you know, they've got a newcomer at safety in Mojet, but the other five players in the secondary are elite all-star level players. Dalvin Bro's come in. He missed the first game because of injury, but he's been really, really good. He's been fit. You know, he looks athletically like the player that was a lockdown player in Hamilton. Lucas Purifoy's done really good things at the Sam spot. TJ Lee's exceptional. Gary Peters gets better with age. Like, this is a good secondary. And then Lacombo and Williams are in front of them, and they're really good. So, defense, you know, both sides of the ball, their line play was the big question coming into the season. And defensively, you know, they just haven't generated pressure on the quarterback for years. Well, all of a sudden, they're doing that now. And so, you know, defensively, I think what they've managed to do is as impressive as what Nathan Rourke and the offense is doing, and they're able to go under the radar because the focus so much is on Rourke.
All right. Well, speaking of Rourke, thank you very much for your time, Farhan, and we're going to have Russ Jackson on the show in about an hour from now to talk about could we be witnessing the next great Canadian quarterback in this league. Always appreciate your insight, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you, and you guys are lucky getting to talk to Russ Jackson as often as you do.
Oh, can't wait. And it's great. Whenever we bring him on in this town as the league back then, as you know, we always get text messages in. Russ was my teacher. You know, because you had jobs back then, and he was a school teacher for all this time here. Yeah, it's all good.
Awesome.
Thanks a lot, Farhan.
Take care, guys.